Yoga Vashishta, Part 17 by Swami Surya Devananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. The last time, we began with the seven states or planes of wisdom, as is in the sixth chapter. And we discussed the first of these seven, which is Shubhicha, or noble wish. Under this, we discussed awakening, renunciate, renunciation, behavior of the renunciate, and focus of the renunciate. Today, we continue and take up the second of the seven states or planes of wisdom of the great sage Vashishtha. Our main focus today will be on these four points: study, right conduct, and meditation being the first, company of the wise being the second, knows what's good, harmful, right, and wrong being the third, and resolutely gives up what is not good being the fourth. Greetings. Let us begin with first having a look at Vicharana itself, the direct and steady observation of the mind, before we go to those four points that we have outlined for today's time together. So what is Vicharana? We've heard about vichara. Vichara means to think or to ponder and things of that nature. But vicharana is slightly different. When one engages oneself in the practice of inquiry or direct observation of the mind or into the nature of reality, and these two are not apart, one has to look through the mind to what's beneath it all. It is called inquiry or vicharana. Now, this direct observation of the mind is not a passive observation, as in I am seeing something and I am disconnected from it. We are not disconnected from the mind. So we are watching ourselves. And in that watching, there is also a transforming. And how does this happen? One doesn't just observe the mind, but one is conscious that one is observing. This is the pivot or the most important part of observation. We have to be conscious that we are observing. Not only are we observing, but we are also aware that we are observing. This keeps us in the observation and doesn't allow us to get mixed up with these thoughts and notions that rise and fall in the mind in the period of observation. This is the most important thing. One does not get lost in the observation. The more clearly one is able to sustain this awareness in the observation, and this awareness in the observation is what makes vicharana completely different from vichara or just thinking or pondering about. This reduces conditioning because we know what is going on in the mind. We do not participate in the rise and fall of habits promptings, and the force of habits promptings or conditioning is reduced by disuse. See, they use up energy each time they rise, and if they are not given any more energy, they weaken. They have gained strength by use, Vashishtha says, they will weaken by disuse. This is why it is essential not only to spiritual practice but also to living without conflict. We may have any of these impulses or urges within us, be it anger or whatever it may be. Let these rise. Don't fight them and let them fall. How do you not fight them? By instead focusing on the observation. Therefore, I am different from this. If I'm observing something, that is the observed. Let it rise. I maintain the observer status. Let it maintain the observed status. Conditioning is not allowed to assume subjectivity. The only time conditioning becomes dangerous is when there is subjectivity. There is no problem at all when conditioning rises and falls on its own self. It's just like waves that rise in the ocean and falls on themselves. There is no problem at all. Water goes back to water. That's it. It loses its momentum when that wave splashes on itself, and water just goes back to water. And that's about the bottom line on that. So what we are going to talk about today is not more in detail about this in some scientific or theoretical manner, but enabling this vicharana. See, the yogi is very different from one important point. He just doesn't want to talk about all of this. He wants to actually do it. Just like chocolate, eating chocolate. He doesn't want to talk about chocolate. He wants to eat it. And that's the bottom line. So the yogi is the same way. He doesn't want to talk about a lot of theory, just enough theory to be able to practice this. And that's why we are going to shift from vicharana onto those four topics that we have outlined about the actual practice. So this mechanism can take root within us and we can condition. And then vicharana goes into inquiry. Looking and observing the mind goes into inquiry onto who we are. Because the field is the same, my friends. We are not going to do vicharana here and then start inquiry over there or with something else. There is one field inside, and this field has to be plowed and made fertile first before we cultivate it, before we do anything to it. The point to remember is vicharana or yoga is not something that the ego does. The ego cannot do yoga. That is the bottom line. Vicharana is the relentless watching of the ego while the inner intelligence does what needs to be done. This is the key thing. We watch the ego and the inner intelligence does what needs to be done. In the initial stages, since this hasn't taken root, we start off in steps. And as I've outlined in my series on Raja Yoga, there are few steps that help in meditation and inquiry being grounded. So, because we are so used to habitually to putting it on something concrete, the mind is put on the mantra and the image. We hold on to the image of the Ishta Devata or our chosen ideal in our heart, and the mind repeats a mantra. At this time, we also know I am that which is repeating and listening to this mantra. This keeps us from getting caught up in the rise and fall of the surge of these thoughts, habit, or conditioning. It is a tremendous benefit to try. I mean, is it possible to go straight into direct inquiry? It's possible, but you have to have a mind that is so cultivated, that is so focused, and to be able to sustain that on long hours of meditation every day, every single day. That is not an easy task. There are some that are suited for it. Good. But for most people, an incremental approach, sure steps, prevents backsliding. And it is these sure steps that we are talking about. So to watch the mind while the inner intelligence does what needs to be done is not only watching, but also empowering the inner intelligence. And the inner intelligence acts, the ego or conditioning is not acting. Every time we're able to both watch and let the inner intelligence act or do something, we're going to weaken conditioning significantly. Let conditioning be there. These thoughts and images might be there, but the energy in them is depleted to such a moment, and the recognition of them as conditioning is so clear in our heart that we are not bothered by it. It is that level of immunity that we are seeking to build. The ego has no room in vicharana. It is weakened by disuse. When the inner intelligence is empowered, it is just not going to be weakened one way. It has to be watched. Something else has to do what needs to be done. Both these things are critical to laying the foundation for vicharana. Vicharana is therefore also the pivot of the ego surrender or self-surrender. Because when the ego is not allowed to act, something else is acting. That is watching, and that which is watching is also repeating the mantra and listening to the mantra, and it knows it's doing that. So it stays there, and it doesn't get caught up in the rise and fall of thoughts. It knows all this is happening within itself. And this is also the surrender of the ego, because the ego has no play. It is being watched, and something else is empowered to act. So where is the play for the ego? Nothing but to rise and fall on its own residual momentum, the momentum that it has infused by force of habit. So therefore, there is no loss in any of this in surrendering the ego, because something that is bigger than the ego, that is aware of the ego, is empowered. So there's no loss at all. And I've had questions often levied to me, but can this vicharana act in our day-to-day life, like say in my work or in my family or something else? What if the ego is not there? Maybe I don't quite relate properly, because the ego is personal, and the inner intelligence, which is what does vicharana, is impersonal. So this is a hurdle that we have to get over. This inner intelligence that we are going to empower is impersonal. But impersonal doesn't mean there is a loss. Impersonal means there is a gain, because it doesn't have selfish ways, and therefore all conflict is taken out of the equation. Absolutely. It does what needs to be done, the right thing, instead of what's in it for me. Every time we do what's in it for me, we strengthen the hand of the ego. Every time we strengthen the hand of the ego, we add to inner conflict, stress, and the problems in our life. Until we look at this equation very straight up and accept it on the tablet of our heart, there is going to be struggle. Now, let us shift from talking about vicharana as a broad topic to those four points that we had outlined earlier, which is making it happen. Okay, we've come to this point and we've outlined for ourselves four main groups of thought that enable or make this vicharana happen, that allow us to lay the foundation so vicharana is ever present and ever going on. The first is study. This study is not only relegated to our desk, to our table, or our study area. We have to be a student. A student is always learning, and we have to be always observing in this vicharana, always learning about ourselves. Very often we hear people say, well, I know myself. Well, then this rise and fall of emotion and that which is aware of it, what about that? That is a totally different thing. What is the source of that? How far back does that go? So the sincere seeker is concerned about this self-study. It's not just study of the scripture, my friends, but through the scripture to study oneself, get the teachings, and practice the teachings which allow you to study or know yourself. So through the scriptures, The seeker seeks to study himself. And Vashishtha has very carefully chosen this word study, as study involves being a student. And this being a student is a completely different attitude. What is this? A student doesn't have any preconceived notions while he comes to study. These notions is what interfere and disallow study. In a politically correct environment, these what you call political correctness is nothing but notions. And the more we participate in any of that, the more these notions are going to interfere and disallow an understanding of things as they are. So the seeker approaches study with a very clear mind, with a very clear heart, holding on to the teachings in his heart. And he ponders how to practice them wholeheartedly. There are three things that are very important, which are the focus of the seeker study. One is right approach, which we have just talked about. No preconceived notions at any time. Everything fresh all the time, because it is. And you may say, I know. You know, my friends, if you sit by a flowing stream, it looks like the same stream. But water is flowing downhill or wherever the stream is flowing. And at every moment, that stream is absolutely fresh. There's fresh water in it all the time. It's never the same water. So it's just like that. The mind is ever fresh, and we have to have a right approach if we want to understand it, because there is evolution going on every moment within ourselves. So that's the first thing, the right approach. Ever fresh, a right take, a fresh take on it all the time, continually. The second is finding the teachings which allow us to progress. And this is by study, by all of the other things that we do, our contact with other great ones who have walked this path in the spiritual journey. And the third is a fiery determination to practice them. Not just to know about them, but to practice them. And so we have right approach, ever fresh behavior of a student, finding the teachings that are important, going beyond all limitations in this. One must know. And if one's current path is not that wide, doesn't have that wide a field of view, you extend yourself beyond it. One must know what one's doubts are, and one must know the answer to clearing them. How do I get beyond these? We're often trapped up, caught up in, well, if I get beyond, I'm going beyond my system or going beyond my religion or going beyond something else. My friends, you have an allegiance to your soul. That's it. We don't have a deeper allegiance to everything else. Everything else supports this. It's a means, but it's not where we are going. It's not towards the end. If the means is not adequate to the ends, the means needs to be expanded. I think Einstein had once said that it's foolishness to do the same thing again and again and expect a different result. This doesn't mean that we rebel against religion or anything else. Everything helps, but one has to know, if my answers are not coming from my current field of view, the field of view has to be expanded, so the answer must be found. The important thing is not the field of view, but the answer. Everything else can be adjusted and expanded. The answer to clear these doubts, because I must know who I am. I must be able to know who I am, which is start this journey or vicharana or direct observation of the mind, so all of this can happen. So these three things are important. Right approach, which is the approach, the behavior of a seeker, the behavior of a student, finding the teachings, which means extending ourselves, getting all of our doubts cleared. We have an allegiance to the soul that is greater than any other allegiance that we have. It has been said before, to thine own self be true. And a fiery determination to practice them in one's daily life and on the mat. Yoga is not relegated to the mat alone. The mat of yoga extends all across life. So the yogi just doesn't want to talk about chocolate. He wants to eat it. He wants to touch it. Not just talk about God, not just talk about truth, but a direct experience of it. Now we move from study, the first part of this first point that we are talking about, to right conduct. And this is where we often come up with a feeling, well, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. My friends, it gets increasingly difficult in today's political climate. And you'll find me going back to that again and again, not as a sort of condemnation of anything in society or anything like that, or a rebellious attitude, not at all. It has been this way since the beginning of time. The spiritual seeker, when you start looking within, the habitual way of looking out and the impartial way of looking in tend to collide. Because habit is not impartial. Habit is partial. That's why it's habit. And so the habitual way does not work. Aspiration collides with habit and conditioning. And this is the change that we are talking about, not any sort of rebelliousness. My friends, it has been this way since the beginning of time. When we are used to one thing and we want to start something else, it may seem rebellious, a new way of finding things over here. It's a pause and a relook and a re-examination. And this may seem rebellious, but we are not concerned about that because that's not our focus. We just want to know, and that's it. So this right conduct, my friends, is not social right conduct or anything else, but bringing into life one study. The bringing into life of one study, what we have studied, is right conduct. Spiritual aspiration is not confined, as we've said, to the prayer area. It extends all through life. And one's conduct, which means one's thoughts, feelings, communication. I would have said speech. The scripture says speech. But today we communicate in many different ways, more than speech. So we have to extend the speech from the scripture, the word speech, to communication and action. All these four, thoughts, feelings, communication, and action, have to and should reflect the ideals of one's aspiration wholeheartedly. If they don't reflect the ideals, they are not being internalized. What we want, we have to grow into what we want. So what we want, the principles of what we want, have to reflect in us. We cannot let the principles of some competitive way of living or something else, I first, me first, any of that, exist strongly in me and that our aspiration be for something else. Because if it exists strongly in you, that is going to deny aspiration. We're looking in the same field with the same instrument. There's no other way. We have to bring all this together into sharp focus. So this is what makes right conduct and gives with a spiritual basis different from social conduct or things of that kind. In social conduct, the deepest aspirations do not have to reflect as the basis for conduct or doing what needs to be done. We can do something else and have different aspirations. And that's okay as far as the world goes. But we are concerned with one thing and one thing only. I must know myself. I must know the truth. And so everything has to be brought into one single steady stream of focus. There can be no dichotomy in this. One's deepest aspiration is the very foundation and basis for right conduct. This is what makes it slightly different from social conduct and things of that kind. Protecting one's spiritual aspiration aflame may appear to be at odds with social conduct at times, because social conducts change and social conducts are dictated in the times by people, by things of that kind, who may not have that aspiration. But the seeker has to protect that spiritual flame. The bottom line is in choice. Do I protect my spiritual flame, or do I go with the flow? And that is the bottom line. When you go with the flow, you go downhill. When you go against the flow, you go to the source. Now, we are not talking about going against the flow, but we are talking about going to the source. And if it means going against the flow, we have to be ready to take a stand in that. That is the key thing we need to understand. So it is best to emblazon one's spiritual ideal or goal in life in the heart first. And this will allow it to reflect very naturally in our life. Very often we are used to starting things outwardly first. Well, if I want to lose weight, I go and buy all the things that I need to lose. You know, the stuff that we need to lose weight with, the videos and the food and the shakes and everything else. Gather the whole support system and then begin. But I'm not fully on board. I don't do all the other things like watching my diet and exercising and all the other things I need to do. Because we start with a lot of the outside first. Be used to this, my friends. And I'm just using that as a very, very loose example. But to start at the outer first without having the ideal set in one's heart, does not give us the stability that we need to sustain the journey. Because the rise and fall and the pull of habit is going to be very strong. We are getting into waters that are going to get choppy. And so we must have a good craft, a good boat. If the boat is not good, we're going to have problems, my friends. It's quite simple. So we've talked about study, right conduct. The most thing important about right conduct, it has to reflect one's aspiration in full measure. That is right conduct that reflects our aspiration in full measure each time, all the time. Now let us talk about the third, which is meditation, concentration and meditation. The mind for meditation is cultivated in the hours of one's regular day-to-day life. We don't have two minds, my friend. And this builds on what we have just spoken earlier, that there are no two minds. We've got the same instrument. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, raise the self by the self. But a very similar thing is said in the Yoga Vashishta also. There are no two things, my friends. We don't call a handyman or someone else to do this work and then we sit by. We can't contract it out. You can't sublet it out to some technical expert or some person that is supposed to be proficient in some theoretical knowledge. It doesn't happen like that. Theory is a totally different thing. Practice is a completely different thing. So where do we start with all of this, my friends? This meditation, the mind for meditation has to be cultivated. In every little aspect of our life, the mind for meditation is cultivated in our daily life. How do we cultivate it? We have to concentrate and meditate in everything in our life all the time. But that takes the fun out of life. No, it doesn't. To concentrate and meditate simply means to be sincere or wholehearted in everything. And wholeheartedness is joy, my friends. Carelessness, being lackadaisical, all of the slipshod, all of that cannot be joy-giving. When you've done something thoroughly with all of your heart and all of your mind, that doing thoroughly is itself joy. It could be a chore. It could be something laborious. It could be something hard work. But if you've done something wholeheartedly, the wholeheartedly itself is joy. You may think that it was joyful doing that, or I experienced joy doing this, cleaning up my garage or cleaning up my shed or cleaning up my garden or whatever it is. But if you've done it wholeheartedly, there's satisfaction. Ah, a job well done. That's it. Why is that not reward enough to do what needs to be done wholeheartedly because it needs to be done on its own merit and then let it drop and then let the attention go to the next thing? As simple as that. So do one thing at one time and wholehearted. If you want to become whole, you've got to become wholehearted. And this training for wholeheartedness has to happen in every aspect of our life, in every chore of our life. The mind cannot be here and there and small little things, you know, coming indoors and kicking the slippers here while the mind is on something else or answering the phone. All that, my friend, this slipshod way of life is going to disallow the fertile mind that is needed for deep meditation. This requires discipline. And this discipline has to be a willingness to imbibe the spirit of discipline that is needed. So, wholehearted with full dedication because it needs to be done. Let's look at this rule very clearly. One thing at one time. Wholehearted, you have to want to do it. Nothing else, that I'm doing this, and when this gets done, my mind is on what else I need to be doing. That's not wholehearted. This is it, and I want to do this. My whole mind should be wholly engaged, mind, body, spirit, everything else, feelings included, in this till it is done. Till it is done and I step back from it, I don't step back from it. I'm in it till I step back from it, till it is done. So this ability to do that is going to cultivate that kind of mind, which in the hours of meditation is going to sit and look at that and not want to be anywhere else. When it doesn't want to think of anything else, ponder on anything else, play with anything else, distractions that rise in the mind are not going to bother it, my friends, at all. Until this momentum is there, we are not going to be able to fight conditioning and go beyond that. It really is quite simple. Not very simple to practice, because this conflict is a contradiction or a dichotomy within our own selves. Yes, I want to do this, but I also want to think about that. This, my friends, is called habit. It's called conditioning. It is something that we have to go beyond to be able to get a good footing in this. So this is a way to become wholehearted, which is another word. Wholehearted is another word for sincere, for sincerity. These two are synonymous. They mean the same thing. Wholeheartedness and sincerity are not two different things. If one practices this type of concentration off the mat, which means in one's daily life, concentration on the mat becomes natural, because we have cultivated the mind and the attitude needed for it in our day-to-day lives. And if we don't do it, it'll be a struggle at best. I know some that come to yoga and then after a little while pull back and say, well, meditation is too difficult, I'm going to shift gears and spend more time on these practices or on that or something else or whatever. That is a sure sign, my friends, of missteps. It may be that we need to do some of that, but the more important thing is examining our attitude. And if that is not examined, the hand of ego is still strong while we are practicing, and the ego cannot do yoga. Yoga is a way to discover and get rid of the ego. When the ego does yoga, the problem worsens, because we think we're going somewhere, but we're in the same spot. It's like the wheels are spinning of the car, but we are going nowhere because the brakes are on. So if one's attention is scattered and diffused in one's regular life, concentration and meditation become a struggle at best. Concentrating the mind in one's daily life paves the way for concentration on an ideal and then to go even beyond the ideal. This gathers the rays of the mind and brings them into focus. This focus is going to allow inquiry to happen later. See, my friends, we're talking about concentration, meditation, and then a way of meditation that is called direct inquiry, or looking directly into oneself. But we have to lay this out with these steps or terms, not because it's a whole lot different, but just to break it up, to look at the dynamics of it a little better. Now, there are supplementary yogic practices that really help with all this also, and I would like to recommend two of them. One is called Tratak. Tratak is steady gazing, and you may take a picture of your chosen ideal or aspect of the divine, put that in front of you, or it could be a om or something even impersonal as a dot or something of that kind. The ability to look at it with concentration to such a degree that when you close your eyes, the vision of it is equally clear, the image is equally clear within you. You have internalized that vision completely. So in Tratak, and I won't go into it very deeply because I've talked about this in my series on Raja Yoga. I keep going back to that so we don't get caught up too much on this, my friends. Please look at the aspect on Tratak. I've covered that in that, and I've also written about that. It's steady gazing. You may take an image or whatever you use. Don't change that. Have that in front of you and look at that with your eyes open continually. Initially, you cannot look at one thing continually without the eyes wanting to move. So move the eyes on that. And if it's an image of a deity or a chosen ideal, then look at the head, look at the shoulders, look at the arms. Move your eyes to different aspects or parts of it, and then to bigger parts or groups of it, and then try to retain the entire image within yourself. Do that when you look at it or stare at it. This whole process of moving your eyes and all of that, try to hold it. It might be only 2 minutes at first, 1 minute at first, 30 seconds at first, 15 seconds at first, but do it again and again till you can build up. At about the 6 minute mark or so, the eyes will get a little bit of tear. There might be tears coming out of your eyes. Get a napkin and wipe yourself out a little bit. Do that exercise about 2-3 times, maybe twice or maybe 3 times. That will build the mind significantly, where we will be able to maintain an image in our heart. When the mind is holding on to this, it is not going to get attracted or lured or tempted by conditioning. This is the main purpose. The mind is not. That chosen deity is also tied into our ideal, what we aspire for. Call it God, call it self-observation, call it whatever. So that is eventually going to flow into that. Not just what it is in an image, but what it represents. This is not just an image of a God or a deity or whatever, but to me, it represents something. See, my friends, we forget about all this, and we have to go beyond all these stuff in the politically charged climate of all this. There's something that it represents. A photo that you may have in your wallet may not be the photo of your daughter or son or parents or whoever else, but it represents them. So if someone hurts that or damages that or tears that, you think that there's something being done towards it. It represents that. That photo represents something. So this represents your ideal. People talk about images and worshiping deities and all of that. My friends, that is loose talk without any basis, unexamined thinking. So don't worry about all of that stuff, of what people say and what people do. Let people do what they have to do. Use the tools that are needed to move on. The yogi is not worried about explaining and getting into conflict or justifying anything. Use what is needed to be able to move on, because the goal is more important, not the means. And that is the most important. People argue about the means. The means is different. This is different. What about this and what about that? It's not important. It's not important at all. It can be dismissed. The only thing important is the goal. And that's it. So, Tratak is one. And the second one is Pranayama, which I've also talked about in the series of Raja Yoga. Pranayama, or yogic breathing, works on the energy. So the energy is regulated because it is this energy that is going to charge all the images in your mind which exist as conditioning. So we get a new image that represents the ideal, and we work on pranayama or yogic breathing to be able to control the energy. Now we've got the image and we've got a handle on the energy. How is conditioning going to act out? Because it's another image. If you've got your hand or your thumb on the energy button, and another image which represents your ideal, which you prefer to all the other images being presented to you. So this is what is critical. And this is where the yogi makes his choice. The mind gets primed for abstract meditation, and meditation results in self-inquiry naturally. Friends, we now come to the second point that we had outlined in this sphere of vicharana, which we are talking about, which is company of the wise. This is not as narrow as it feels. Company of the wise is also company of the good. Let's look at it a little bit closer. Company of the wise is the glue that binds our life with one spiritual aspiration. What we aspire for is what is going to guide our choices across the spectrum of life, in everything else. We don't usually have one string that runs through all of our life. And more so today, and I'm not conflicting at all, my friends, with the times, I'm not complaining about, it's always been this way. When you want to look within, and when you want to look at the spirit, which is uniform and the unifier, it is going to look a little bit different from all the fragmented existence that we are used to. So there are choices. There is this unifier within. And this unifier within is going to bring things into order outside. See, my friends, it doesn't matter what we are doing. Through all the things that we think we're doing the same thing. Activity is a mirror to the mind. We're looking directly into ourselves while we do this because we're examining our motivations. What is my motivation in all this? So, no matter how things are, we always have the choice. And what are the choices? To increase inner goodness is the only choice, or other things. My interests and everything else that comes up, all of that, all the other choices, you can put them in one bucket. All the choices. To the seeker, there's only one choice. How do I do this? So I increase inner goodness. So there is this natural inner flowering, inner blossoming. I can see myself. These are the only two paths. All the other and increasing goodness. A wonderful scripture called the Katha Upanishad has this instruction as a very critical instruction in the beginning, the opening of Yama's teachings to Nachiketas, which starts actually in the second chapter. And it refers to these teachings as, these two paths, as Preyas and Shreyas, the pleasant and the good. Yama tells him that there are two paths. Both these are open before each person all the time. The pleasant and the good. What is good is different from what is pleasant. What is pleasant is not always what is good. We won't get into that much, but my friends, I would really recommend reading. That's a smaller scripture, not that deep. Not that extensive, not that long, very deep. The second chapter is where this focuses on, but do read the whole thing. These two things are the paths that are before us. These are the only choices that we have. Another great teacher has once said that you have only two choices, to face the light or to face your shadow, and that's it. So in different ways, it comes down to the same thing. This is the very basis for spiritual progress, knowing what is good, what supports one's spiritual ascent, and the second part of it, the wholehearted willingness to practice it. People always say, well, I know what's good. True. Okay. Do you practice it? So there is a difference. Where is the, why should, if you know what is good, what is the problem in practicing it? There are two different things. This thing called independent will is not part of that. I know what's good. I know what's good is in one part of our mind, and independent will is tied to habit. When these happen, my friends, you've got a tug of war with the carriage going in both directions. And that's a formula for breakdown. There's no way around it. So how do we find a way to clear and resolve this conflict or dichotomy from our lives, from others that have gone before us? And this is where Company of the Wise comes in. Now, Company of the Wise and Good is not limited to or relegated to simply programs that one goes to, or a little camp or little outing or little stay at a hotel or whatever. None of those that one goes to for a little bit of time, a gathering with some religious or whatever theme, and then we come back and it's the same old business as usual. Business as usual is a no-go. Everything has to be done in a way that supports observation, which is seeing how I am, who I am, as I am, and transformation. These two aspects have to be on continually. Observation and transformation. I must see all of these rising within me, the force of habit, and I must make better choices continually, each time, all the time. This is the journey that goes through habit, through the conditioned mind, onto the expanse of the unconditioned. So the way to get established in this is not easy to understand. But in the behavior of those that have had a footing in this field, one can begin to get both tremendous clues and inspiration for this journey, because both these are going to be essential. Not just how, but also being able to see it and then knowing, I too can do it, and I too will do it. So this is what's going to fight the tide of all kinds of struggle. The company with the good is a company with one spiritual aspiration, because that spiritual aspiration should be reflected in the company of the good. And it has to be the basis for all our life, not just one part or one aspect of our life. This wholehearted embrace removes struggle from the journey. And if struggle is felt, it only means that there is a lack of this wholehearted embrace of the good in our heart. Friends, this brings us to our third point for today, and I know we've gone on, but I'm getting a little bit deeper into this, not because of anything else, but because it needs to hit home as something that we can leave, that I must practice this, it's good for me. Now let us go on to this knowing what is good, harmful, right, and wrong. And we may think we know that, but social conduct or knowing what is good in the workplace or in the family place and things of that kind is conditional. It has in relation to this particular type of atmosphere. But knowing what's good is knowing what increases inner goodness. Now that inner goodness is not conditional. It's not subject or tied to this condition. I know what's good and appropriate in each situation, but is it appropriate? Is it raising my inner goodness? I may even become a hypocrite that way to do things that are just socially or outward, but they have no, I don't really believe in them. I'm not tied to them. So this knowing what's good is an inner belief in it at the same time. Inner belief is what's guiding the outer, not anything else, not an acceptable type of thing. It has to be acceptable to your aspiration, not acceptable to society and this and that, but acceptable to your aspiration, to that which you are trying, your deepest aspiration in life. Again, friends, let me bring to mind again and again, only because we exist in a very charged political type atmosphere. We are not trying to go against the stream. It has always been like this. The inner and the outer get into conflict when one tries to get out of the clutch of habit and move towards freedom or the inner path or one's true nature. Habit collides with aspiration, my friends, and therefore it seems like a conflict, which it is in a lot of ways. And they, in many places, I've even heard it talked about in books and things like that, like the spiritual war. The spiritual war is not out there, my friends. It's not out there with people that believe in something and don't believe in something. This spiritual war is internal, completely, against the force of habit. Aspiration and habit vie with one another. One has got the energy infused by habit, and aspiration is like a young seed. And this seed has to be nourished while there are heavy rains and all the elements. And if you're fond of gardening and you like gardening, you know that every plant, if you've seen every plant come up, really come up and looked at it almost every day or often, and you've seen it grow from a small sapling, from a seed, into a plant that can stand, withstand the withers of force of climate, that plant has struggled. And if you want to know what struggle is, my friend, do that and see a plant, and if you see it outside in the elements, you might need to protect it a little bit here and there, but just watch how that struggles. Just watch. It's a fantastic thing to watch. You can watch this in different aspects of life also. I don't know if you've ever seen an elephant, a baby elephant. After it's born, the mother pushes with her leg. She pushes the baby elephant to stand up. And the reason she pushes that, because they must move. Elephants must move to their water source. And because they move, that baby elephant is subject all the time. If it sits there and doesn't want to feel its legs and get its legs or whatever, it's going to be easy prey, easy picking for a lot of the larger animals that are there in the forest. Because it's clumsy, it cannot move at that point. So the mother will push it, and it seems brutal, but it'll push it, and then it'll start moving. And the instincts of that baby elephant will take over to stand up and also to fall, find her feet or his feet, and to get moving and to get walking. It's a fantastic thing. All of nature has so many examples of this ability of reliance. God has given us this ability to be able to learn from within, to be able to learn. So we have to know what is good. The mind for concentration and the mind for our daily lives are not two different things. Therefore, resort to the company of good in all things, better choices in all things, a better way of doing all things, wholeheartedly, with our full mind, not distracted, not all of that stuff, as if this would be the last thing that we would do in our life. My friends, our choices add or subtract from our momentum in spiritual practice. Think about this. This is what makes it essential to know what is good, harmful, right, and wrong. Get beyond all this social, all of that stuff. Leave that for the people that want to look at that. What supports my aspiration? And how should I do it in a manner that supports my aspiration? I will have to have deep observation. I'll have to have total attention and concentration. Therefore, every task, however mundane, has to be done the same way, because the mind for meditation is being cultivated in my normal day-to-day life. If this feeling is felt in the heart, my friends, then the path becomes much more easier or free from struggle. This may stand at odds with today's atmosphere of multiple tasking, all of these other things, my friends, but it's been this way since the beginning of time. Aspiration has always seemed at odds with habit, though it's not, but it seems as if it has, it's at odds. There are other scriptures that have wonderful examples that say, be in this world, but not of this world. It reflects the same theme down to the T. It's impossible, my friends, to please two masters, the flesh and the spirit. or aspiration and habit at the same time. Very difficult to do this, impossible. This doesn't mean that we need to be odds at all with the world. The world will go on with its own momentum and direction, let it. You don't have to approve of it or disapprove of it, let it. You are inspired by another mood, support that, support your inspiration. Don't worry about anything else. Why are things that way? Because they are, as simple as that. What has it got to do with me? I am concerned about this, I must know myself. Once the seeker worries, concerns and focuses to that degree, the focus sharpens to that degree, to the degree the focus sharpens and in the intensity is felt, the other things or vying or fighting or the conflict one has with other things ceases. This is a bridge that has to be crossed over, my friends, that everyone has to cross at some time, at some point. It's a sort of pivot, a bridge. The seeker has his own direction and momentum, and the seeker is set on his goal and what is truly worth seeking. When this level of clarity fills one's heart, there are no choices at all. It doesn't make a difference what I'm doing, because the why I'm doing and how I'm doing is the same way. Why I'm doing is so I must see myself, and how I'm doing is wholehearted. These two are the same. And so gradually all activity in whatever aspect of our life, be it professional, social, whatever it be, it all begins to melt together, because the outer begins to become a means of self-discovery and self-transformation. And it doesn't make a difference in what field it is or in what shade or color it is. It all is being done for the same purpose. When this level of focus comes into life or just floods life completely, my friends, there's tremendous momentum. And this is also what is called sincerity. Sincerity is being fully on board what is good and what is right. And it is this fire that does away with the allure of any temptation. Inner conflict, my friends, is a sign that this clarity has not yet dawned in the heart. Friends, we now move to the fourth and last point, and I know we've gone on and on and on today, but I would like to have this as a sort of chat with you, where we can share and talk about these important things and look at them a little deeply. And since we're not able to be in a sort of dialogue in this medium where we can go back and forth, and I cannot do that with everybody, we'll do that through this video. And I would like to feel that we are going and trying to answer the questions about things as we go along. So this fourth thing, resolutely giving up what's not good, knowing what's good, doing the good, and resolutely giving up what is not good. This is the focus of our fourth and last point. We've talked about sincerity. Sincerity is a pivot in the spiritual journey. And we discussed in the last point about bringing about this level of sincerity, one thing at one time with all of our mind, all the time, being on board. When sincerity blossoms in the heart, my friends, it is a fire that burns up any existing conditioning in the heart, and new desires or new condition is not allowed to blossom. The mind wants something, the heart wants something so completely, so fully, that anything else doesn't have the room to grow. It's not given any oxygen at all. Aspiration sucks up all the aspiration in the room. I mean, all the oxygen in the room. Sucks up all the oxygen in the room. Aspiration sucks up oxygen. It doesn't go to anything else, and therefore nothing else can act out. If it is going to something else, that's where the problem is. That's where the problem is. And we need to develop that. So it's a fire that burns up all desire, everything else. Sincerity, my friends, we've been talking about it again and again, What does it simply mean, coming down to brass tacks? Sincerity simply means that you are fully on board your deepest aspiration. That's it. And it's the end or resolve of all conflict. Will all the distractions and will all of that be there? Let them be there, my friends. What difference does it make? You are concerned with your aspiration so fully and completely. Let them be there like background sound. What difference does it make? So both these must be there. You must have the deepest aspiration that you value more than everything else. It must be the thread that threads your entire life, all aspects of your life, so everything can start coming in focus together. And you must be prepared to do what needs to be done towards its attainment. So not only must we have that aspiration, but we must be able to move towards its attainment, towards its actualization. Attainment, actualization are the same thing. Realization, it's the same thing. This is sincerity. Deep aspiration and your preparedness to do what needs to be done towards its attainment. Why? Because simply aspiring is going to do nothing but actually frustrate you. You aspire for something, but we're not fully on board, we're not moving towards it. So this tears within our heart, my friends. This is a frustration that tears within our heart. We want to do something, but we are not going to empower this inner intelligence. We're going to tie its hands. We want to go somewhere, but we are not going to release the brakes. We're just simply going to rev up the engine. What is that going to do, my friends? Nothing. So giving up of negative qualities like pride, envy, vanity, desire, and delusion is giving up all the things that stand in the way. It is these things, with these things, that habit is going to try and pull you back. Habit will pull you back with these negative qualities. And that's why we cultivate the positive qualities and do away with this, because that is how habit gets a hold of you. Just like if someone has your phone number, they can get a hold of you or call you. Well, conditioning also has your phone number. It calls you through these negative qualities, pride, envy, vanity, desire, and delusion, and all the rest of it. Because we used to go on those pathways. They were our buddies before. We have to be very careful not to go on those pathways again, because we know where that road goes to. And how do we do that? By having a new road, by having new principles completely, instead of these negative qualities, by embracing good qualities. We spoke about that in the last topic a little bit. See, my friends, it's redundant, but it's all coming together. If you try to see, the theme of what we are trying to talk about should be getting a little bit clearer. So instead of struggling with the giving up, we focus on the aspiration, which is the attainment. It's always a struggle giving up if you don't have an attainment. Yes, I'm giving this up, but what will I have? I have nothing. When we have something, there is no struggle with giving up because we have something better. So the having something better in our heart is that resolute. That's what allows us to resolutely give up. To resolute means with a resolution that I want that, not this. So the giving up becomes easy when the resolute is there. The resolute is that resolution in your heart that makes all this giving up natural. I just don't want it because I want that. I don't have to struggle with this because I want that. That's it. As simple as that. So while focusing on aspiration and all that supports it, you have to still recognize the force of habit, because habit is still going to be there. And the way to avoid it is by strengthening your aspiration. We don't fight habit, we strengthen aspiration. Let habit, which has gained strength by use, weaken by disuse. This is a very strong focus and something very unique to Vasishtha's way. If there is a slip to the negative qualities, there must, and there will be in this path, there is a lot of stumbling. Even when that baby elephant had to learn how to walk, it falls a few times. But it goes on because it knows the parent is going to leave it behind. that is the sort of punishment it has in his mind, that if I don't get up and go with them, I'm on my own. So there must be an intelligent system of accountability or intelligent self-punishment, as we have discussed earlier. This is what makes it resolute, that if I slip and fall, a message is going to be sent to, so that I stay on the path. This intelligent system of self-punishment is positive and not punitive. My friends, it checks or prevents backsliding, which is a big frustration for spiritual seekers. So not having this system is not having a way to prevent or check backsliding. In today's politically correct climate, this differs because the political correctness absolutely abhors any kind of self-accountability because it's all based on the ego, nothing else, 100% on the ego. And the ego cannot do yoga. We are concerned with, I'm not concerned about bad-mouthing any of that. I'm concerned about talking about yoga and the ego, which prevents yoga. So one has to maintain a deeper understanding for any real progress to take place. And it is very necessary to see that all these negative qualities keep you from what you consider truly best. The struggle on this journey lessens in proportion to your being fully on board your own aspiration. If there is struggle in conflict, you say my spiritual life and my secular life and my social life, if all of this is there, we are not fully on board aspiration because spirit threads every aspect of our life. It is the same mind, my friends, that you take to your social life, to your work, to your family, to every other aspect, and on the mat, in your spiritual practice, you don't have two minds. To be able to say, I'm going to go from this compartment to that compartment to that compartment, this mind, or put this hat on and then put that hat on, my friends, is a silly game we're playing with ourselves that really is not going to get us anywhere. We have to see that truly for what it is and call it truly for what it is and give it up resolutely. Regular, meaningful study of the scriptures, service of the teacher, and relentless vigilance, these three, are an excellent way to prevent any backsliding, an excellent backdrop for cultivating the heart and the mind in one's spiritual journey. Friends, it's been a long session again, but there is no other way to do this except to go into it with the hopes that we are touching on things that may answer some of the questions that may arise in those that are spending time with us. We have talked about vicharana, or direct and steady observation of the mind. And the most important thing about enabling vicharana, how do we get this going? How do we get it started? How do we practice as something natural? We spoke about four points that will aid this principle. One, study, right conduct, and meditation. And we focused on each one of these three, but we grouped them together as one point. The second was company of the wise. The third, knowing what is good, harmful, right, and wrong in relation to your spiritual aspiration. And the fourth, to resolutely give up what is not good and what does not support your spiritual aspiration. Next time, we continue with the seven states or planes of wisdom by discussing the third state, tanumanasa, tanumanasi, or a thinned and weakened mind. Friends, thank you for joining me today. It's been a long session. To download this video, its audio, or a PDF handout, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.